Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Roman Catholic Sisters first traveled to the American West as providers of social services, education, and medical assistance. In a new book, Across God's Frontiers, Ann Butler traces the ways in which sisters challenged and reconfigured contemporary ideas about women, work, religion, and the West. And she demonstrates how religious life became a vehicle for increasing women's agency and power. Some very interesting histories as Roman Catholic Sisters joined the migration to the West, joined in the hardships and thrills. But this history, she says, has been somewhat neglected. Writing in the preface to the book, real, quote-unquote, women, says, partnered with men for a truly fulfilled life. And the sisters' history has not been told in full until now. Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920 is the book. Ann Butler is trustee professor emerita at Utah State University, past editor of Western Historical Quarterly. It's a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be connected to Utah State University again.
You live in Florida now?
We do, on Amelia Island, which is quite different from Logan, Utah.
Yeah, I would imagine.
No snow.
No snow, yes. We've had kind of a mild fall so far, not a whole lot of snow.
Have you really? That's amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of different. But in a report earlier today, there's an event coming up which is called Pray for Snow. So some of us are praying
well,
for snow.
Well, don't send any of it to us, please.
This is a fairly timely topic. We've just had in the news the past week or so, news that Sisters of St. Benedict are leaving. The last of those sisters are leaving Ogden.
No, really? I did not know that.
Leaving for their mother organization in Minnesota.
Wow.
And it's kind of brought to mind remembering the great impact that those sisters have had in the Ogden area. They came in the 1940s to build and operate St. Benedict's Hospital.
Yes.
And they're leaving behind a foundation.
I know those sisters very well.
So that is in the news. And, of course, you wrote an op-ed piece not too long ago in the New York Times. Some of the issues that you write about in the book are still very timely today. The Vatican edict reproaching American nuns for their liberal views on social and political issues. That is something that's in the history here as well. How did you get into finding this history and writing about it?
Well, actually, I started my work as a Western historian researching criminal women in the West. And my first work was done about prostitution in the American West. And then I did a book about women who were incarcerated in men's penitentiaries in the West. And what began to emerge from that research was a realization that nobody really did anything at all for criminal women except make their lives more horrible, except Catholic sisters. And I would notice in the record that a criminal woman had tried to commit suicide and she was taken to the sisters' hospital where she recovered, or the sisters in Santa Fe had gone to the penitentiary and visited with the women inmates. And so that got me curious as to, you know, how many nuns were there out there and what were they doing? And then, two, every newspaper in every urban area would always have an advertisement for the Sisters Academy and for education for young women. So I began to do some basic research to see if I could just get a rough idea of how many Catholic sisters might actually have been living in the area that we call the American West, say from after the Civil War until about 1900. And my first calculations showed me that there were probably at least 10,000 Catholic sisters spread all over the American West. So immediately that said to me, here we have a whole community of women who are living in the West and are of sufficient number that they are making some impact, some kind of statement on Western life, and what was that, and what was the West like for them? And so those were the basic questions that got me going, which was actually more than 25 years ago when I started.
This is 25 years in the making.
Oh, yes. This is what we call a life work.
Yes. Very interesting history. And as I quoted you from your preface, the narrative, the myth that's been well established is, are women in contemporary or conventional family life.
Yes, sure.
And so nuns would be, their history wouldn't be as well known because it wasn't part of that.
Well, I think we've always promoted knowledge about American family life, and particularly with the development of women's history as a field of study, the attention that was paid to domestic life, domestic experiences for women, what that represented in terms of labor, in terms of finances, in terms of community development, these became topics that were of great interest to historians. And the unmarried woman, more or less, is on the margins of that investigation. And certainly unmarried women who were living in convents and living what appeared to be a very secluded life didn't seem to be of much importance, I think, as women's history really began to flourish in the 1970s and 80s.
It's interesting reading about the Catholic bishops and their recruitment methods. The need was there because, in part, because they had trouble getting priests to go out and build
yes.
up the church in the West.
Yes, and of course, priests live a very singular life, particularly at that time. They were by themselves in little parishes or little missions. And in fairness, this is extremely difficult living situation. They were often European men who had just been dropped down in the Dakotas or Montana or someplace with virtually no understanding of where they were coming. And I think that that solitary life, as well as the enormous demand, you know, a single priest being responsible for ministering to people over hundreds of thousands of square miles was daunting. I think in fairness to the priestly community, it was a very daunting assignment. So the sisters have the benefit of living really in better community or more structured community, two or four or six together. And that, I think, made a big difference for a lot of women who were in really desperate kinds of environments in the West. So I think that helps to explain why so much of this Catholic work in the West fell to the sisters. They just did not have the number of priests that the bishops would have liked. And so they turned to women who have a very secondary role in the Catholic Church, but they turned to women who were anxious to make their mark and to contribute, and so they were very receptive to many of these recruiting visitors who would come from America to Ireland or France or Germany and beg the Mother House to send sisters to America.
And the picture, in some cases, would be idealized.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact, I must say some bishops perfected the ability to write a letter, a recruitment letter, that really had nothing to do with reality in the West. And they would talk about how there will be a lovely little convent waiting for the sisters, and it will be clean and have a fence around it, and how they would have access to their church sacraments in the language of their homeland. So if they spoke German, they would only have a German priest, and that the people were just waiting for them to come, and the economic prospects would be terrific for the sisters. And then always the letter would conclude with some kind of statement that the weather was never colder than 70 degrees, you know, or something. So there was a lot of myth-making in these recruitment letters to the sisters.
Yeah, these are supposed to be, these are priests, right? They're not supposed to be bending the truth that way, but they needed the people to come, I guess.
Well, I think in the management of any institutional church, what you find on the ground floor everywhere, you find a lot of politics. Mm. And the kind of manipulating to how can we get this in place or that in place. And I think that was certainly involved, was let's get the sisters here. We know once they get here, they'll work hard. They'll do the job for us.
And on the other hand, the sisters would have come out of faith, mostly?
Well, they also came from being pushed out of Europe because there was a great move against institutions of religion. Catholic monasteries were shut down. The Kulturkampf in Germany in the 1800s. As with all immigrants, there were a lot of push-pull factors. And as sisters' convents in Europe were being shut down, it's like, well, what are we going to do now? We either have to go back to our families and work in the family bakery or whatever, or maybe we can stay together as a sisterhood if we go to America. And, of course, they heard about French immigrants and German immigrants who were desperate for schools and for churches, and this inspired them to join that whole migration out of Europe because they felt keenly that they had services to offer, especially hospitals and schools initially, for their own countrymen who had moved into various parts of America. So you find a lot of Germans, for instance, in Wisconsin. So there are a number of German sisterhoods who gravitate towards Wisconsin to start their monasteries.
Mm. I wonder if you could, I'd like to get to know who these sisters were, and maybe the best way to do that is in specific. Maybe you could select a sister and tell us in brief her journey. This must be quite the journey. You're used to, in some cases, a very quiet, cloistered monastic life. You embark on this adventure, and what an adventure it must have been.
Well, I think a person who really typifies what you're asking about is a woman by the name of Mother Odelia Berger from Germany. And she was part of a very small community of women, just a handful. And they started their work as a congregation by taking medical care into the homes of people in the area. But as the political pressures came down on Catholics in Europe, she began corresponding with a German man that she knew who had moved to St. Louis, Missouri, and pretty much saying, we have no prospects here. The future is very bleak for sisters if we stay here in Europe. Do you think we have any chance in America? And he encouraged her to come and probably sent a little money. I mean, they were so poor, it's just sort of unbelievable. And so she came with five other women, and that was their whole congregation, you know, six women. And they settled in St. Louis, Missouri, because that was where she knew this one person. And in St. Louis, the Archbishop was really desperate to do something for the immigrants, because they were just in such poverty. There were no public medical services to speak of. And so he agreed to allow these German sisters to move into one of these German neighborhoods and begin in-home health care to German families. So right there is a radical departure from what we think of with Catholic sisters. They're not just living cloistered behind a big fence, but immediately they rent a house in this very poor neighborhood by the waterfront, and they go out and advertise on the street. They ring a bell to advertise who they are and that they will come into the home and care for the sick. And they don't charge anything for this. They just, you know, if somebody can give them a loaf of bread or somebody can give them 25 cents or how they virtually beg for a living. Hmm. But this is a very different profile from what we think of when we think of Catholic sisters. Now, Mother Odelia, having assigned these different women to go into the homes, she would tour through St. Louis, and she would beg for food and for money, and she would take the linens back to this little poor house, this shack that they had, and she would wash them, and then she would go to the different homes of the sick and give the sisters clean linens, and she'd bring a little food, and she would tell them funny stories from the day, and she would have special prayers she would encourage them to say. And so these German immigrant women built a presence inside the German community of St. Louis. And from that, managed to stabilize their congregation, attract a few German girls who were living in the area to join them. And when the nursing services, often a whole family would die, the disease was so wildly virulent, pretty soon they started bringing the children, the orphan children, back into this shack of a convent. And so from that, they branched out and started an orphanage. And then they started an actual infirmary in St. Louis. So their story of transformation from German sisters living in a very small community in Germany, very kind of traditional life, to this whole health organization that addressed the needs of an entire poverty-stricken group of immigrants is, I think, a remarkable American story. And they went on to become one of the largest and most influential of health care givers in St. Louis, Missouri, and remain so today. They were originally known as the Sisters of St. Mary, but their name has been changed to the Franciscan Sisters of Mary. So I think it's such a remarkable story of immigrant growth, of women as workers, of incredible courage in the face of great poverty, and of the strong personality of Mother Odelia, that she could hold that group together when they were in such desperate condition and keep them motivated and focused to aid the German community. I think it's a very powerful story.
We're talking with Ann Butler on the program today. Her new book is Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920. And she says the sisters reconfigured contemporary ideas about women, work, and religion, and the West. They shaped the West shaped them. These were women on the margins, and we'll talk about other people on the margins that the women sought out and helped and were affected by as well. When we come back from a break, I'll ask Ann Butler to talk about a history of conflicts between these sisters and the church hierarchy. That is something that is ongoing today. In fact, a Vatican edict recently reproached some American nuns for their liberal views on social and political issues. That's definitely an echo of incidents that happened earlier and in the West. And I'll get Ann Butler to tell us the story of Mother St. Andrew Felton and her battles, and this interesting idea of the fluidity. That's why she calls them Catholic sisters and not nuns. We'll come back and talk much more about Catholic sisters in the West, across God's frontiers, following the break.
The bidding has started at Utah Public Radio's Holiday Online Auction, where you will find art, electronics, restaurant, and travel packages. These items are located statewide, and you can still add your item to the auction until the auction ends Tuesday, December 11th. Check it out at upr.org.
Next time on the Putumayo World Music Hour,
we'll highlight guitarists around the world, from Latin America, Africa, Australia, and Japan. I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for World Guitars, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
We're talking with Ann Butler on the program today. I'm Tom Williams. You're listening to Access Utah. Ann Butler is trustee professor emerita at Utah State University, past editor of the Western Historical Quarterly. She lives now in Florida. Her new book is Labor of Love, Over Many Years, Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920. Roman Catholic sisters first traveled to the West as providers of social services, education, and medical assistance. In her book, Ann Butler traces the ways in which sisters challenged and reconfigured contemporary ideas about women, work, religion, and the West, and demonstrates how religious life became a vehicle for increasing women's agency and power. And you're welcome to join this conversation at 1-800-826-1495. That's toll-free anywhere you're listening, 1-800-826-1495. Or you can email us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. And Butler, in your op-ed piece, it's earlier this year, Nuns on the Frontier in the is the headline that the New York Times gave to this. You link up this conflict between the Vatican and some American nuns. There's an edict that reproached those nuns for their liberal views on social and political issues with the past, and specifically a very interesting, fascinating story of Mother St. Andrew Felton and her running battle with Bishop Neras. I wonder if you could recount that.
Well, I think the point that I wanted to make in the op-ed piece is that actually the sisters' liberal views have always been challenged. They have actually always been very strong social advocates of the poor and the marginalized, and there are current liberal positions on which they're being challenged, but they were always being challenged, and they were always being challenged on issues of autonomy and independence. So there is nothing new in that kind of problem for Catholic sisters. Now, Sister St. Andrew Felton was a very young sister, 23 years old, when the superior was displaced by the bishop. And the struggle of these sisters of the Congregation of Divine Providence was just incredible. Because this sister said that her nuns were running the school and had control of the curriculum in the school, three priests decided she was overstepping. And so this became a kind of challenge from the bishop, in which she was brought in to be questioned before a commission or a panel of three priests, at least one of whom was one of her main accusers. And then the bishop reached out to the whole congregation and said that if this Mother Superior was reelected, he essentially threatened the entire congregation that they would be suppressed. Now, that might not sound like such an awful thing in today's world, but in fact, this was the livelihood of these women. They lived together in community. They had schools or hospitals. They did not have family to fall back on, biological family. What exactly would they do if they were suppressed, which would have put them outside of the Catholic Church, which is another obviously important element to them, to be more or less denied access to the ritual of their own church would be very painful. So even with all of that hanging over them, the Sisters of Divine Providence reelected on two ballots Mother St. Andrew. And the bishop, again, he came to the election, which is really not what the bishop is supposed to do, and intruded himself. And eventually, she was just forced out. There was no way that she could stay without such penalty to her congregation that she left the congregation and she went back to secular life and moved to California and cared for the children, her nieces and nephews of her widowed brother. And the bishop then elevated Mother Florence, who was only 23 or 4 or 5, as the Mother Superior. She had the fearsome job of bringing the congregation back inside the approval of this bishop. So she faced incredible hardship in trying to protect the future of her congregation, the finances of her congregation, the livelihood of these women who depended on her. In the meantime, the bishop is still so angry with Mother St. Andrew that he threatened other bishops who wanted to grant her a sanctuary. He wanted her deported and sent back to Europe. I mean, he became obsessed with making her life as miserable as possible, even though she was not even any longer connected to her congregation. 6 years after his death, she was able to petition to be readmitted to the Congregation of Divine Providence, and the sisters agreed, and she came back, and the bishop who was then in place agreed that she could return, but she was not permitted to live at the Mother House. She had to live at a convent in another town, because I think it was feared that she would be too much of a symbol of rebellion or independence. And she was welcomed back among those nuns with great affection and great emotion, because they recognized how much she had sacrificed in her life for their congregation. So it's, I think, a very moving story of one woman and of the tremendous danger that could come to a congregation of sisters if they incurred, or if one sister incurred, the wrath of a bishop.
So there is a lot of jeopardy here, because this is, as you point out, this is their living.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you're in a little mission in rural Texas in the 1880s, and your order is suppressed and disbanded by the bishop, there aren't a lot of options there for poverty-stricken, unmarried women. Mm-hmm. I think they would be quite overwhelmed to have the carpet pulled out from under them, so to speak.
It's interesting to me, this kind of points out a fluidity that you talk about as well. Apparently, Mother St. Andrew, in the middle of all this, where she couldn't get into another convent before she was readmitted, she laid aside her religious clothing, you write, returned to secular dress, and cared for her widowed brother's children.
Yes, she did that in California. But then I think, you know, they were grown, and that was not what her calling in her life was to be. And, you know, she was very committed to the Congregation of Divine Providence, to its ideals. She was a woman of faith. Her family, to her, consisted of all the sisters. You know, that was her adopted family, not her biological family. But she would have, you know, if we think about it, really been in quite an untenable economic and religious position if she had not had the widowed brother to whom she could turn. So she was actually fortunate that she had that option.
By the way, you, and following up on what I was talking about, this fluidity, you talk about Catholic sisters in the American West. That's your subtitle, Sisters of Catholic Nuns.
Yes. There's a difference between Catholic sisters and Catholic nuns. Nuns are women who take solemn vows and live under a rule of enclosure, which means that they enter a monastery and they live in that one monastery typically for their whole religious life. They don't move around. They have a closed ministry. Their life is principally devoted to a ritual and prayer. Sisters, on the other hand, do not take formal vows, do not live by the rule of enclosure, and have what is called an active ministry. In other words, they are going out deliberately and seeking work among secular people. They find jobs and service entities that they can offer to the people of the community, not just to Catholics. But in our world, everybody kind of calls sisters nuns. The words have become interchangeable, even though the definitions are different. And so I have used the words somewhat interchangeably in the book, but often use the phrase nuns and sisters because, in my view, many who started out as European nuns transformed their congregations into sisterhoods, and they gave up that enclosure, and they adjusted their prayer rituals, and they took on active work in the secular community. And so, although we all say nuns, in actuality, they are American sisters that we are talking about.
We're talking with Ann Butler, author of Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920. And she says that these sisters challenged and reconfigured contemporary ideas about women, work, and religion. And religious life became a vehicle for increasing women's agency and power. Very interesting stories here. We'll get her to tell us some more stories of specific Catholic sisters. I want to talk next about something you write about. These sisters are on the margins of society, and you write they intentionally sought out centers of social and economic upheaval and other marginalized peoples to serve.
Absolutely. That is the goal of sisters. In the mind of the congregation, which is a whole sisterhood of women, they establish a ministry, and it's agreed-upon ministry that they write into their congregation. It might be the education of young girls. It might be care of the orphans. It might be schools for children of color. But it's very specific to each organization. What is the mission that they are going to carry out? And so they go out and seek these communities wherever they can to bring assistance, education, religion, comfort, and at the same time to earn a living for themselves because nobody supported them. They had no little purse that came to them from the Vatican or the church pastor every month at all. They had to support themselves. So just like Mother Odelia in St. Louis, they often do so for 25 cents or 50 cents, and then they put it all in a common treasury. But they live with great frugality among the most poor of Western people, whether they're immigrants or whether they're indigenous people. And we find occasions, for instance, in Salt Lake City, St. Mary's Academy, which was a very prestigious school run by the Holy Cross Sisters, And sometimes people see those kinds of institutions and think, oh, the sisters are really living well and only the wealthy can afford to send their children, their daughters, to that kind of academy. But in reality, the sisters inside that academy are taking every penny they're getting from their wealthy students or the families of the wealthy students, and they divert those funds to their poor schools, to their little mission school that's free for African American children, or to their little mission that they're running for Native American children someplace on a reservation. So that although they have a few institutions around that appear to be really prosperous and substantial, they are dividing up their money so that they can get the most service to those who are in poverty and in great need.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about the nuns, the sisters' relationships with Native Americans. In some ways, this would have been typical for those in the West. Others, atypical. They would have, I think, through their through the church, denounced indigenous cultures as paganism, for example.
Yes.
They would have had commonly held prejudices, probably weren't immune to those. But on the other hand, they lived, in some cases, right with Native Americans. So that must have changed them over time.
Well, it is, I would say, a very complicated historical relationship. And I think there are many perspectives that need to come to the discussion about Native Americans and Catholic missions or Christian missions of any kind, in fact. And there is absolutely no question but that there was coercion, there was great hardship, there was cultural destruction for Native American people, and that is actual and documented. But I say that the relationship is complicated because at the same time, as you have just said, the sisters themselves were living in and with Native American people. They came to know Native American families over many generations. And I think one finds in Catholic sisterhoods a great evolution of sentiment and of understanding. And sisters beginning, when they first get there, despite the regulation by the United States government that everything had to be conducted in English, the sisters would immediately start to study native language of whatever group of native people with whom they were living. And they would use native language in church music. So it was always a kind of dual identity. They were participating absolutely in this reduction of culture that native people would only identify as genocide. At the same time, the sisters were doing something very few other white people in the country were doing. They were actually living among native people and learning from them. And there's a little sister, an Ursuline sister, who lives among the natives in Montana for 10 years and writes back to her mother house, "You have to forgive the way I express myself, for I am now more an Indian than not." So I think that change came over a long period, but I think it also prepared Catholic sisterhoods for the upswell that we saw in the demands of people of color for civil rights in this country. And I think because of their background and because of the impact that people of color had on them, American sisterhoods were ready to endorse and participate in the civil rights movement, to change their ministries, their missions, their schools, gave people of color a place to gather, to begin to articulate their public platforms. So I think it's been an incredible story with great pain and hardship, but also great illumination and change.
We're talking with Ann Butler. Her book is Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920. Talking about the ways these sisters shaped the West, how the West shaped them. And Ann Butler says that these sisters reconfigured contemporary ideas about women, work, and religion, and the West. When we come back from a brief break, I'll have Ann Butler tell me about what she calls a woman for the West. She devotes an entire chapter to Mother Catherine Drexel. We'll talk about Catherine Drexel when we come back.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan inviting you to tune in to the next Wood Songs broadcast. We have Pert Near Sandstone and from England, Sarah McQuaid.
Spring follows winter, sun follows shower.
It's music and conversation on the next broadcast of the Wood Songs, Old Time Radio.
That's Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Coming up on the next Bluegrass Breakdown, we'll be headed to the new Bluegrass CD bins in search of one of the most highly prized creations in all of high, blue, and lonesomedom, the CD reissue. I'm Dave Higgs, and we'll have a handful of them, blasts from the past from such revered artists as Walter Forbes, Buzz Busby, Reno and Smiley, and many more on the next Bluegrass Breakdown.
Saturday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
On Access Utah today, by the way, I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Ann Butler, who is Trustee Professor Emerita at Utah State University and past editor of the Western Historical Quarterly. Her new book from the University of North Carolina Press is Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920. Very timely topic, I think. We've learned of the leaving of the remaining nuns of Sisters of St. Benedict from Ogden, and learning, if we didn't know before, the great legacy that they're leaving behind. They came in the 1940s to build and operate St. Benedict's Hospital. They're leaving behind a substantial foundation, which will continue to benefit nonprofit groups for the next 5 or 10 years. And we're going back in the past, seeing how these Catholic sisters shaped the American West and were shaped by the American West. Ann Butler, our guest for another 6 or 7 minutes. You're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Our email is upraxis@gmail.com. We do have a caller. We go next to Mary in North Logan. Thanks for calling, Mary.
Oh, thank you for having me. And I'm just excited about your book because my mother was born in St. Paul in a German neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And the neighborhood has changed. It's now more Hispanic, but I remember growing up and being over there a lot. And I wondered if you did any work at all when you did your St. Louis work on the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, because that is the order of nuns that I went through. Through all the way through school, through college, and now they, the university that they founded, well, the college they founded in St. Paul is now a university, the University of St. Catherine.
Well, I'm very well acquainted with these sisters, and I did work in their archives, both in St. Louis and at St. Catherine's in St. Paul.
Oh,
and there's quite a lot in the book, actually, about the sisters in St. Paul, as well as the sisters from St. Louis. So, yes, I do know those sisters very well.
Okay, and they still do a lot of that social justice kind of work with the marginalized.
Well, they were one of the largest communities, the Sisters of St. Joseph. They just exploded in terms of membership. They were very successful at recruiting young women, and they are—they have an incredible history as educators, and they have wonderful archives, I will tell you that.
Oh, okay. Well, I go back there for every reunion, so I'll have to check that out. My other question was, when you said that the enclosed nuns took formal vows, the other nuns also take final vows. Is that not the same thing?
Well, it really is not. They sort of, after 1920, in my view, they sort of tried to mix what it meant to be active and enclosed. And even in the 50s, sisters would say, well, we're a semi-enclosed congregation.
Okay.
And there really is no such thing. Either you're enclosed or you're not.
Or you're not. Yeah.
And I think that after 1920, there was really quite a conservative period for the sisters, where their congregations got much wealthier, things really stabilized. But then I think when they hit the 1960s, that they really reached to their pioneer roots in this country and the experiences that I have described that have them out in the community.
Yes,
so much. And then I think they were just prepared to say, well, these were our origins. This is what we did. And this is what we should be doing. We should be out again with marginalized people.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Certainly, I'm going to go look for the book.
Oh, excellent. That's fine.
Very good. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Thanks
thank
for calling.
Bye.
And Mary called 1-800-826-1495. You're invited to join the conversation. Just about 3 or 4 minutes left with Ann Butler. Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West is the book. 1-800-826-1495. As promised, I wonder if you'd tell us about Catherine Drexler. You devote a whole chapter to her.
Well, when I was teaching women's history at Utah State University, I had a whole lecture on women and religion. And I would ask my class, now, how many of you have ever heard of Mother Catherine Drexler? And I can say 100% of the time in 14 years, nobody had ever heard of her. You know, and yet she is one of the most, she's really the most influential Catholic woman of the 20th century, the 19th and 20th century. She was from the Drexler family in Philadelphia. She was one of three daughters, and when her father died, she and her two sisters inherited just an enormous amount of money, and this was before income taxes. So they really inherited the money. She, of the three sisters, wanted to be a nun, and for several years she was dissuaded by her local priest from becoming a nun because the Drexler sisters were so interested in philanthropy, and they were interested in the education of children of color, all three of them. And they devoted their resources, their millions and millions of dollars, to this purpose. They would either build industrial schools that a community of nuns like the Franciscans would run, or they would support little parish schools. Catherine Drexler was particularly interested in Native Americans, although certainly equally, I think, African-American children in the South. But she loved the West, and she went to the West as often as she could. She supported the mission efforts of probably 20 or 30 other religious organizations, of sisters and of priests. And she would lend out the money, and she would expect repayment, but, you know, she had a low interest. And she single-handedly supported Catholic education for children of color in this country, because there really was no money coming from the bishops or from the annual collections. And even the bishops complained that wealthy white Catholics, just didn't seem particularly interested in the education of African-American and Native American children. And she was an incredible businesswoman. She had learned this from her father. And so she maintained this amazing banking of care and education for all of these children of color. Plus, she was supporting all of these other religious congregations in their mission work. And she lived to be 98. She actually died when I was in high school. I remember it quite clearly. And it's hard to measure the impact of this one woman on the system of education for children of color and the lives of sisters and priests in other organizations. And the church was perfectly happy to let her carry this burden. It is estimated that she probably spent over $10 million on the education of African-American children, and there's no estimate on what she spent on Native Americans because she was very secretive about it. She didn't want anybody to really know how she was running the money. Mm-hmm. And she was the founder of Xavier University in New Orleans, which is the only university for African-Americans, Catholic university for African-Americans in this country, and it is flourishing today.
I wonder if you could, maybe some institutions in the West that we may not immediately connect up with some of the Catholic sisters that you write about, the legacy that they left.
Well, I would certainly point to St. Mary's Academy in Salt Lake City. I think that was St. Mary's of the Wasatch was a hallmark school of the Holy Cross Sisters. St. Michael's Mission in Arizona was one of great importance to Native American people. That was owned and operated by Mother Catherine. St. Catherine's Industrial School in Santa Fe had a huge impact on all of the surrounding villages in New Mexico. In California, the work of the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur, who came in the 1850s to California. In the Northwest, the work of the Holy Name Sisters, who founded academies, and the Sisters of Providence, they were both from Canada, who founded hospitals, as well as the Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth, who were in Montana, the Daughters of Charity in St. Louis, the Sisters of Mercy in Oklahoma. So you see they've really spread their work for the poor all through the West.
It's interesting, it's inspiring in a way as well, that what a few determined people can do over time. And that's highlighted by the Sisters of St. Benedict that's in the news. They're leaving for Minnesota, the legacy they've left behind here in Utah.
They are an amazing community of women. I know them very well. I was there when their monastery in Ogden was dedicated, and I'm saddened to think that they are leaving the area. But they are a remarkable group of women, and there is quite a lot in the book about their mother house in Minnesota.
Well, we're out of time. Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West is the book. Ann Butler has been our guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. It was terrific.
And tomorrow, hope you'll join us for a discussion of liquor laws. Should they be loosened to promote economic benefits? Should they be remain where they are to promote public safety? We'll talk with Senator John Valentine, among others. We'll debate liquor laws. Should they be changed? Should they stay the same? We hope to have your call or email as well tomorrow. And for our producer, Shalane Smith-Needham, I'm Tom Williams. Thanks for listening to Access Utah Today.
You're listening to KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.